Yeah, I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just catapulting towards some greater purpose?
Cats with bloated ego. We are the only DJ crazy enough to tattoo Jackie Brown on his ass.
This is Michael Mann, and I ride with
extended clip.
Edwards or whatever, back in the day, back when I was going to community college out in Santa Clarita, because I was like, I gotta go there. It's my kind of cinema.
There's one in Canyon Country that definitely used to be in Edwards. I don't know about the one.
I would just see those on the 5 when I was like driving really far. That's how I knew I was just way out of my comfort zone, is when I would see Edwards' theaters.
When you're in Hick Country.
Yeah, exactly. I can't wait to go back to Hick Country. Santa Clarita.
Deliverance starts playing when you see that. You're now leaving Los Angeles County.
The way that there's that, you know, the classic giant Paul Bunyan statue, you know, there should be one like that for like Ned Beatty and Deliverance when you cross over from the valley into Santa Clarita.
The guy who gets...
just gets quivering.
That's funny to make the statue out of him. One of our favorite characters in the movie. I haven't listened to too many rewatchables, but I remember the Deliverance rewatchables being funny. Just Bill Simmons reacting to like the Deliverance rape is just gold. I don't. It's just like.
I know it doesn't look like he loves it, Mike, but he loves this. He loves it.
I got to hop back onto that because the rewatchables is a very hard show for me to listen to for the most part. It's battling in my head, you know, the removed but somewhat sincere love for the man himself, the big dog Billy, and the absolute lunacy of the show and the other the goons at the ringer or whatever. But apparently the most recent episode was on Hardcore by Paul Schrader, and I'm very tempted to go check that one out.
That sounds awesome.
By the way, when I say the lunacy of the ringer, if any of them want to, you know,
I was gonna say,
shoot me some commission work, whatever, you know, Sean Fennessy, you want to come in the pot, I would love to have you. He seemed like a really smart guy, you know.
We love the ringer and a lot of other publications too, you know.
Yeah. Bill Simmons was a big fact checker type, like he did like a CinemaSins type review of the movie we're about to talk about right now. Ooh. Though back in the blog days, I think he may have softened his position on it. But welcome to Extended Clip. I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Averill.
I'm Malcolm Baum.
I'm JT White.
And we're talking about He Got Game, the 1998 film by Spike Lee. And yeah, there was a really funny, like, old, early 2000s page 2 blog from Bill Simmons in his The Sports Guy era, when it's, like, borderline racist the way he's like, there's no way someone that broke was not gonna go pro, you know?
Really? That was his take?
That was his take on the whole movie. It's like, the movie's not unbelievable because there's no way... If he was that good and he was that broke and from that broken of a family, that college wouldn't even be in the equation, you know?
I get what he's saying. I kind of misinterpret, but still, that's not great.
That's wild.
When I said racist, I was alluding to some other nuggets from the review that I don't want to, you know, let's not get into that.
We're not trying to air people out here.
Yeah.
We're not trying to get anyone in trouble, you know?
Times have changed, you know?
But I was, that's interesting. I could see, especially early 2000s Bill, maybe not appreciating this movie, but.
Well, I think there is a lot of leaps in logic in the movie, you know, and I think if you're taking that kind of hyper realist CinemaSins approach, then, you know, there are going to be a lot of nits to pick, if you will. And it does invoke the real world. I mean, there is kind of a gap between the first half and second half in a way where in the first half we even have like these in-universe like SportsCenter featurettes featuring all these real legendary players and coaches and all that talking about the legend of Jesus Shuttlesworth played by Ray Allen. So it feels like it's trying to take place in the real world of sports in that capacity, but there's also a lot of stuff that is very, you know, fanciful, like as Simmons alluded to about how college, you know, just wouldn't even be an option for someone like that. If the money is right there, and of course the fictional college that they have to make up, because no college would actually want to associate with this movie, so he has to go to Tech U and gets the cartoonish frat boy treatment, you know, and also the legal procedural element of this with Denzel getting out on a quote unquote work release from prison after killing his wife, so that he can convince his son, who happens to be the number one basketball prospect in the country, to go to the state college that the governor was an attendee of, a graduate of. And it's a kind of fucking ridiculous plot.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's one of the most, now that I'm saying it all out loud, one of the most ridiculous stories you can really think of. But then almost every sports movie that we love has a pretty ridiculous angle that you have to kind of buy into to separate it from the reality. And, it, you know, all of these sports movies show something about the game and the people who play it that is compelling to us, you know, and that's why He Got Game works, is because it's not about the NBA in 1998 or college basketball and recruiting in 1998. It's about a biblical level father-son melodrama about how radically far can you push someone while still asking for forgiveness afterward. And the radical ending, I think, is just, I don't know, one of Spike Lee's great melodramatic swings in his whole career. And I think, like, separating this movie from reality is what makes it so great, and what makes the core relationships feel as titanic as they do at the end of it.
Yeah, and, like, it's still steeped in, like, a sense of reality, because it addresses, like, these real world issues, you know, in very meaningful ways. And, you know, even the fact that, you know, Jake Shuttlesworth is, like, allowed to get a work release from prison to convince his son to join this college basketball team just kind of shows you, you know, there's some corruption at the heart of, you know, of these sports, college sports and professional sports.
Damning as it might be of the legal system, it's even more satirical of the ridiculousness of the corruption of college sports. Like, yeah, the ridiculousness of the premise is just to show how, as I just said, ridiculous the reality of college sports is. You know, it's a different type of ridiculous and unbelievable. And this is a subject that goes back forever. I mean, there's, like, A College Coach by William Wellman is an absurdist college sports corruption movie. You know, there's even elements of it in the John Ford 1929 military academy comedy Salute, which is about the lead up to the Army Navy football game. You know, it's always been there. And I think Spike has always been a very over the top filmmaker, and he uses that to his advantage. You know, he has so much to say, and he has so many stylistic tricks in his bag that he has to try to throw everything at the wall. And I think that's why the kind of absurdity of this movie is why it works so well. It just, like, really puts so much fuel into the fire of the main melodrama between Denzel and Ray Allen, who gives a pretty clunky performance, but I think I would say Denzel makes up for it to still just, like, the two-hander stuff works perfectly for me, because Denzel is that good.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, obviously, it's very clearly sort of awkward with Ray Allen, but also I think it kind of gets a pass because that character is at that sort of point in his life, and obviously he is Jesus. He is this huge, like, basketball prospect, but, like, I don't know, he's still figuring things out. He's supposed to be, like, obviously a young kid, so that, I don't know, I'm able to elide that a lot. And there are just so many major, like, formal swings and decisions in direction here that just, like, more than enough make up for it. Like, I saw Malcolm today you tweeted about the soundtrack,
yeah,
and how it's Aaron Copland,
yeah,
scores, and it has this feeling that evokes like the West, totally. And it's just like this huge, like larger than life scale. Even sometimes, like I think from the very beginning, when you open in Jesus doing like a pickup basketball game, it like, I don't know, adds a level of immensity to it that I don't know, replicates like obviously the excitement of actually watching a game.
Yeah, it's kind of strange how the soundtrack fluctuates between Public Enemy and, yeah, the Copland score that sometimes is even like the Lone Ranger theme or whatever it's called in the credits, you know? It's like really just straight up old-timey Western compositions, and it creates a really great dichotomy because it's like, what is this movie about but a black subject, black community, black filmmakers? Public Enemy is providing the song portion of the soundtrack. What did Spike Lee go to film school and study and influenced him so much? Stuff like John Ford and Ilya Kazan and Billy Wilder and all these classic American filmmakers whose films were very white. And I feel like there is a built-in dialectic to any time Spike invokes classic Hollywood. You know, he makes a point of it and stuff like Bamboozled, but it's always going to be there that this guy has studied the system from the inside out, going all the way back, and he obviously understands that racism was built into that system from the beginning, you know? And so I feel like there's always a kind of a political trail to go off if you want to, anytime Spike Lee, even in his most commercial films, is invoking a kind of classic Hollywood feeling or even just a piece of music that feels maybe anachronistic to a bunch of, you know, teenagers in 1998 on Coney Island playing pickup. You know, attempts at making it feel grandiose are also, I think, very well accomplished. Mm-hmm. You know, the stylistic flights of fancy, whether it's the crazy crane shots or the scenes that are color graded very experimentally, even sometimes, you know, those are misses, like when Lala character is fucking hulked out in green, and you know, it's like he's never been subtle with his stylistic choices, but that's why he puts so many of them in the movies, you know. Mm-hmm. And I love that aspect of the movie.
No, I think the dichotomy you were talking about before, you know, with the soundtrack and the movie, like it's also kind of present at the beginning where we kind of have the beautiful opening shots of, you know, mostly kids playing basketball, and, you know, and mm-hmm. he makes a point to show white country kids, Larry Bird type players, you know, practicing basketball, and then, you know, showing, you know, black kids playing basketball in like inner cities. And, you know, even that first meeting with the warden, when they strike up that deal, like the warden, you know, makes sure to mention, you know, James Naismith, you know, invented this wonderful game, you know, this white creator. And also, it's funny that I've seen that actor a lot before. I can't remember his name, but he looks like Steve Clifford, the Hornets coach.
Ned Beatty?
Yo, is that Ned Beatty? Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Goddamn.
We were just talking about building a statue to that man.
True. You know? Yeah, Deliverance. you know, it's, you know, that's a points off my card. You know what I mean? That's
well,
for sure.
Well, look, he looks a lot different in the you know, assault scene in Deliverance than he does in He Got Game. Okay. You know, it's understandable. It's called being an actor.
Well, then
you
I should
be unrecognizable.
I should word it, Steve Clifford kind of looks like Ned Beatty. That's how I should word it, out of respect.
Well, you know, some of those games where the Hornets were down like 40 this year, I get, you know, there's definitely shades of certain scenes of Deliverance there.
Just got to sit there and take it, you know. You just wait till next season, you know, reload after the draft.
LaMelo Ball is just like in a cast playing the dueling banjos thing up in the seats, you know.
Charlotte's pretty country, right? Country enough, you know?
Yeah, right, yeah. as we talked about, the movie starts with a very indecent proposal to get Denzel Washington's character out of prison to, you know, do this quote unquote work release kind of thing. And it's presented with a lot of style, like a lot of wipes and fades help the exposition go down a lot easier. And that's where it feels like Spike Lee's taking a lot from Kurosawa, the way he uses wipes. You know, I feel like you could trace it to George Lucas, but George Lucas also got it from Kurosawa. And, you know, I feel like there's always been a understated line between Kurosawa and Spike Lee in their over-direction and over-acting in their movies. I mean, High and Low getting remade by Spike with Denzel is going to be perfect because they're just as, you know, 11 out of 10 amplified as Kurosawa and Mifune were in the best way, you know. So we get a little intro to how Jesus is living. You know, he lives in this weird apartment setup where his, I guess it's revealed later that his coach was helping him get hooked up with, you know, where his legal guardian now is his weird ass uncle who's always rubbing mojo all over himself. So he got like his own apartment in the same project building with his sister, who he kind of is the de facto parent of now. And, you know, Denzel comes back into their lives, and right away it's just pure rejection and resentment. And slowly over the course of the film, we get more and more flashbacks of what their relationship was when the Ray Allen character Jesus was growing up and he was a kid. And we get these like endless, you know, scenes of Denzel just drilling him like the worst parent coach you can imagine. And then slowly throughout the movie, it builds up to the climactic flashback, if you will, the game that he's playing one-on-one with his son. And it's pretty funny when you think about it. It's just like if it wasn't scored by that epic music and everything.
Yeah,
you
no, were just a dad getting there. Drunk yeah. and just like just belittling his son.
Just doing hard fouls, blocking the shit out of him, you know. And it's the classic, you know, he's got to toughen the kid up, but he goes too far, of course. And this is when the young Jesus throws the ball, yells, "I quit." And that gesture comes back later in the movie, of course, but he then goes inside and it shows the horrifying sequence of Denzel throwing his wife across the kitchen and her accidentally throwing her right into the kitchen counter, a blow to the head that kills her. And I mean, Spike's ability to kind of fluctuate in tones here is really impressive because, you know, within 15 minutes of this, we get some really raunchy, like, stuff in terms of sex comedy almost. And like mugging while Ray Allen has a threesome, and you cut to Denzel like totally mugging into camera, like, what's going on here? You know, and but I think both of those moments play perfectly. It's a real balancing act of tones that he's able to pull off. It's maybe one of his greatest skills as a filmmaker. Is like, it feels like five different movies often on a pure tonal level, but somehow they all feel in place.
Yeah. And I mean, they're all sticking to that like larger than life, like melodramatic scale. I think that really keeps it there. Cause like there's a consistency in that ridiculousness, even if like the family drama element isn't as goofy. Like it's still like we're like amplifying the stakes like as much as possible. Like if Denzel's character wasn't such a hard ass for him, like Jesus would obviously be more willing to like forgive him, but there's already that like pre-existing resentment there before he accidentally kills his mother.
And I love the shift in tones and kind of all the different characters. There's a lot of different characters in this movie, a lot of like regulars in Spike Lee movies for the, you know, for the auteurist fans to recognize. And it's a big, like, slab of movie. It's like, you know, almost 2 hours and 20 minutes. And, like, there's a lot of different, like, I think of the cop characters kind of as, like, comedic relief. There's just always, like, giving them shit. And pretty funny when, like, at first they're, like, checking in on him. in his like new place, and Denzel's making like a grilled cheese with an clothes iron. Yeah. Very so good. Cobra Stallone-esque kind of, because he's a very, you know, I like his character in this, you know. Obviously he's a guy, you know, he killed his wife by beating her, so he's not a great guy, but you know, he has an electric personality, and you know, he kind of reminds you of some of like maybe the great athletes who really had like a stern discipline, although him himself, you know, kind of drinking, you know, maybe he didn't quite stick to the sports, you know, altogether or whatever, but you know, it kind of reminds you of like the tough mentality of, I don't know, some famous athletes that he's trying to instill in his kids. And I really think, I think the, like, I really do feel the intensity in those scenes with, you know, a younger Jesus Shuttleworth and Jake Shuttleworth. Like that first scene when Jake Shuttleworth shows up for the first time after coming out of prison, and he meets him at the court, and they kind of go back and forth, and you know, Jesus is talking about how he hates his name, and there's like a flashback to when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you just get a lot of emotional depth out of that meeting, and you know, their relationship always kind of being on the court. Really the only time Jesus is kind of willing to talk to him is, you know, when they're you know, on a basketball court. I really like that relationship, and like you know, even though there's some funny aspects, I always feel like, yeah, the emotions hit in those scenes. So what about Mila Jovovich? How do you guys feel about
that? That's what I was going to get into. Yeah. When you were talking about how many different characters there were, and to go back onto the tonal shifts throughout the movie, we also see Denzel's, you know, view on, his views on women in this movie, the Jake character, are not great. You know, he's very, but he becomes more polite and just pays his due for sex, I guess. But it's very funny to see him talk about, you know, it's the downfall of many a great man was a woman, you know, to his son, when he's just a guy who killed his wife and now is paying the woman that he met next door, who's getting beaten up really bad, paying her for sex. But it's a very strange relationship. It's touching in spots because of how good of performance,
mm-hmm.
yeah, how good of performers they are. But I would say that whole stuff is written a little more lackluster than the rest of the movie, you know. It doesn't quite land the same way, although I do enjoy her pimp telling her that he's trying to, or that I do enjoy Mila Jovovich's pimp named Sweetness accusing her of trying to plantationalize him.
Yeah, no,
it's a funny piece of dialogue.
I definitely agree with Eddie that it is like obviously kind of the weakest angle of the film, but not to say that like it isn't enjoyable and like again like touching at points, like the Denzel character sort of like wanting a sexual outlet, mm-hmm. I feel like, mm-hmm. first and foremost after being like locked up, and then ultimately it sort of being like an emotional angle, like because he's obviously like cared about his wife, like that is at play there too, sort of comes out. But it does like,
oh fuck,
shit,
god damn it, I'm sorry. It does call, I feel like, some of the weaker and like, I don't know, exaggerated comedic moments of like something like Jungle Fever, mm-hmm. like where it's like, mm-hmm. I don't know, Spike Lee getting a little, I don't want to say just misogynist with it, yeah. But yeah.
I mean, you know, that's a legit, that's an accusation you could throw at him, I think.
Yeah, it's, and I would just call you racist for saying that.
I don't like lots of parts of it, you know, but like, it does produce some moments that only Spike could produce, and like,
exactly.
Kind of his kind of, you know, craziness sometimes. Like, I think of the sequence, like it is somewhat interesting towards like the back end of that stuff where, you know, Jovovich seems to be aware. It's like, why are you over here? Like, I know you're trying to have sex with me, but if there's like, you know, a weird, like he's still feeling compelled to spill his emotions. And then of course him, when he finally gets to have sex with her, he busts very fast, you know, and she comforts him. And then I just think that's a great sequence where, you know, Denzel busts fast. Jovovich kind of comforts him. And then he goes to his wife's grave, takes a knee, you know, kisses the grave. And then we cut to, you know, Jesus kind of coming back from university and having to deal with Rosario Dawson, you know, character kind of accusing him of cheating. And I don't know. It's just like that's only Spike could create those three scenes in succession to each other.
The funny thing about that also is the lead up to it, because the parole officers give Denzel the money to go get laid.
pretty sick guys, to be honest. It seems like they're having fun and just having a New York vacation while Denzel has to, you know, do alternative stuff to recruit his son.
The killer instinct and stuff like that about Denzel's character, as far as basketball is concerned, Malcolm, you were talking about how it evokes like a certain type of famous athlete, and Kobe was actually considered for the role. Funny enough, it's the way it's cited on Wikipedia seems like it's from a very bitter fan, because it's like Kobe was considered for the role, but after airballing multiple shots in the first round of the playoffs, he needed to work on his conditioning over the summer and opted out of acting. It's like, geez, that's rough. That's
so funny. Those are the facts. Wikipedia coming through with the cold, hard facts of life, you know?
But, you know, it's what you would later call the Mamba mindset, and it's evocative of, like, Jordan and Tiger Woods and all these obsessive athletes. Obviously, Tiger Woods also was a very young man when this film was made, but he would go on to demonstrate this type of killer instinct and this very singular, selfish, if you will, mindset, where the only thing that matters is being the best, because of a certain self-recognition that you have a certain gift and needing to exploit it to its furthest possible end. And you could tell that that's maybe Denzel drinking, his character drinking could be what prevented him from going pro. You know, there's allusions to him being a great baller in his day, and then we see him at his weakest. You know, his most insane moment is when he's getting drunk and abusing his kid.
No harm, no foul. Are you hurt? You bleeding? Huh?
What you think? I'm gonna see you get pushed like that.
Take it out. What, you gonna cry now or something?
Why you gotta push the ball?
Take the ball out.
And I quit, man. And I quit.
You quit? What?
I quit. I'm
out of here. Oh, you out of here now. You want to quit like a little bitch, huh?
Be a bitch.
You better go get my ball.
I ain't get a damn thing.
Jesus.
Daddy, leave me alone.
Jake, that's the wrong shit, man. I'm out of here, man.
Fuck, that's why I ain't gonna make it.
You know, right after killing his wife. So that could have been the weakness. It could have been women, as he alludes to. It could have been, you know, an insatiable lust or something like that that led to his downfall in basketball. But he grooms his son to be the same way. And it's a mindset that is, you know, tried and true for a lot of professionals, but also has its very clear downfall. And I think there's a reason why, you know, Spike Lee, in addition to this, did that Kobe Doing Work documentary, where you're just listening. It's basically like a mic'd up game where he's shooting Kobe for the entire game. And I think that he's really interested in that psychology, because it creates these larger than life figures in their own worlds. It's like you're creating this Jesus-like figure. You have to be a savior for your family and your extended network, because you have these God-given skills on the basketball court. And so it's like, well, if I am that good at scoring a basketball, I do need to shut everything else out so that I can get a huge deal and then take care of all my people, you know? Mm-hmm. And then it just turns into selfishness and greed over time, and obsession, and, you know, violence, as we see in this film, and hatred and distrust of women and all that good stuff that we see as the downfall of men in movies like this and all kinds of stories like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously like no coincidence that like names you had mentioned, like Jordan and like Tiger Woods, like do seem to have very similar relationships with their fathers to the one depicted in the film. I mean, it's very obvious that like the characters in this are rich, and I feel like every scene you sort of unravel like a new angle that like complicates things. And obviously, yeah. Spike is an accomplished writer in that regard. But I think with that sort of mindset, it is like an element at play there where it's like obviously Denzel sort of has it both ways, where it's just like he gets to rationalize to himself, well, like, no, I'm pushing him for like this is good for him. But also like feeding into that very selfish element of ego where it's just like, well, I crave this future and I want him to sort of live vicariously through him.
And to take it a step further, like the downfalls of that being, you know, a selfishness and shutting everyone out, it matches the style of play that he wants his son to do. He idolizes Earl Monroe for scoring.
And my all-time favorite ball player was Earl Monroe. Oh, the Pearl. Yeah, he was nice. See, everybody remember him from the Knicks, you know, when he helped win that second championship and everything like that. But I'm talking about when he was with the Bullets down Winston-Salem Stadium before that, gave him 42 points a game the whole season, 41.6. The whole season. For the Knicks, they put the shackles on him, man. You know, on his whole game, they locked him up like in a straitjacket or something. When he was in the streets of Philly, playgrounds. Oh, he was like, you know what they call him?
What?
Jesus.
On the old school Bullets or whatever, you know, and this is like the Jordan 37 points a game season just happened before this, and this is the Mamba mindset of throwing up 28 shots a game or whatever, and it you can read into that truly as like that. It's a selfish way of playing. It's not about the teamwork and the camaraderie of basketball as it's shown in a lot of other movies. A lot of other sports movies are about teams coming together, you know? One, there's like, he's with his cousin, and toward the end, there's a lot of good feelings there, but all you know is that they dominate in pickup and on the high school court because of him, because of Jesus. And that's about it. You know, it really is all about him. And I think there's definitely a built-in critique there in terms of both personality and basketball personality.
Well, that's something I feel like I wanted to bring up just in general, like regarding like basketball movies, because I want there to be more basketball movies,
sure.
Basketball fiction. I feel like there is very little of it, or at least very little that's like good or not like aimed at 13-year-olds who we need to encourage to read.
Or to encourage to turn off their PlayStations and go outside for 60 minutes a day.
Yeah. Obviously, baseball is like noted as the American game, but that I feel like is something that is like inherently like a team sport. I mean, aside from like the very individualized personal elements of like being a pitcher on the mound, I feel like basketball can sort of blend itself to individual stars and talents and things like that
totally.
Sort of overwhelm. And the fact that the movie is concerned with that and wrapped up with like Copeland's like Western scores, I feel like sort of mythologizes basketball as like one of the premier American games.
Yeah.
Like I just wish, I don't know, there are other sports movies that were this good.
And exactly.
I mean, one's about basketball and certainly.
I mean, this movie is, you know, a pretty large critique of, like, basketball and, like, sports culture at large, and kind of, like, how, you know, like, obviously, like, basketball is seen as a means of, like, social mobility, you know, these young black people in the, you know, the projects and whatnot. All the hoopla that comes with that, you know, everyone expecting, you know, a payday, and people, you know, agents trying to take advantage of you, trying to, you know, show you extreme wealth, you know, Ferraris and mansions, and, you know, convince you to go to the league, you know, maybe instead of college. And yeah, I mean, obviously most sports movies are about like a team winning a game, you know, this is about, you know, an individual who's kind of caught up in, you know, the matrix of the sports world, and kind of is seeing how it affects his relationships with the people he knows, and, you know, how it complicates things. And but it's from a perspective that, of course, of someone who loves the game, obviously, you know, Spike Lee obviously loves sports. And what JT is talking about, it's like, yeah, you know, you see, you know, those opening shots of it shows how beautiful basketball is, you know, just the shooting of a ball itself, and how it, you know, there's just so much to it. And Spike Lee really examines that in a way that, you know, Rookie of the Year maybe doesn't do for baseball. You know what I mean? I guess maybe that's why people like Moneyball so much, because maybe Moneyball does a little bit more examining. There's not a lot of sports movies that I guess take that position, you know, but also kind of maintain that respect and love for the game itself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You're kind of selling the body horror element of Rookie of the Year short, you know.
True, you know.
No, you're right, though. And I think Moneyball being about the people who assemble teams is there's something kind of at odds with that and the romanticization of baseball in the movie. It's kind of weird. We talked about this on an episode like 5 years ago now. And yeah, it's like, It's a well-made movie, but it's also I think my feelings and Malcolm's feelings both, and JT, maybe you as well, I don't remember, but I remember being very at odds with what the film was trying to say and how the film seemed to approach the game, you know?
You know, don't get me started on the A's and Moneyball and how it was all a sham. It was the wool being pulled over our eyes.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a good read, though, when it came out, so I get why people liked it.
The ending of this movie is fucking insane. You get the one-on-one game to decide the fate. You know, is Denzel going to serve his full term in prison, or is his son going to sign the letter of intent to go to Big State? I love the two fake schools they talk about, Tech U and Big State.
Yeah, it seems like Big U's more like kind of like the opposite of Tech U in a way, right? Like Tech U seems to be like, you know, party suburban, party, like, you know, and like, you don't really get to see Big U, but you just assume that it doesn't have
Big State to you.
Oh, yeah, Big State. I'm sorry. Yeah, of course. You know,
come on, man.
We got to respect colleges. I respect Ivy League. I'm into colleges. So, yeah, I respect. I respect Ivy. I, you know, when someone tells me that's Ivy League, I'm like, oh, shit. You know, I straighten my posture.
Yeah.
You straighten your posture when you learn that a school is in the Ivy League.
Yeah. Oh, Harvard University. Of course.
So, as we were talking about, we get the very operatic ending where the game is to decide the fate, and Jesus dominates his dad, just fucking knocks him over and slams on him for the game point two, and walks off the court with the swagger. But he then learns that his son has decided to go to Big State to help his father's chances of a shorter time in prison. And that's kind of the graceful moment of forgiveness that Jesus has done. Jesus has forgiven the sins of all of mankind? No, of his father.
After he does wind up going to Big State, it is revealed that it's a sham, that like Ned Beatty, like, is like, they're not actually going through with like the release. Like, obviously the ridiculous premise does not like, that's not actually happening.
And they had to report it in the papers as Jake having broke out of prison. Yeah. But then toward the end, we get a little intercutting of Jesus and Jake shooting some hoops on an empty court, as we did in the beginning of the movie. But this time, a prison yard and a giant stadium where he's going to be playing for Big State are the two locations. And Denzel looks like he's about to do suicide by prison guard as he walks into the forbidden zone in the prison yard. And he's got a sniper trained right on him. And imitating the gesture that his son had done years ago when he quit the game, which is, you know, you could say that that's what really sparked the violence in Denzel to eventually kill his wife, is that his son quit, which is just the worst thing he could ever imagine. He repeats that gesture and throws the ball over the fence, you know, to quit that system and that life and everything. And maybe he's okay with getting shot in that moment if he does. And he doesn't. Walks right back on the court. But the ball ends up miraculously on the court where Ray Allen's shooting around. And it's really just a biblical, metaphorical, whatever you want to call it, moment of a man getting through to his son because his son has forgiven him. And that ball ending up in that court, whatever it means to you about, real hoopers and forgiveness and father-son relationships and God, it can mean to you. But it's a beautiful, just thunderous ending. Like, I feel like Spike Lee really never took a bigger swing than this one because of the potential, world-beating implications of it all, And so I think that the operatic ending pushes it over past all its flaws, and it's a 4.5 bullet movie for me. One of my very favorite Spike Lee movies, probably like top two or three. Malcolm, what about you?
I mean, I guess in terms of ending, I guess Jungle Fever, you have to shout out Jungle Fever. That is pretty wild. But no, this is 4.5 bullets for me too, because I mean, I don't know, any talk about flaws is, I mean, there are some, but it's like this movie's so endlessly watchable with all its like kind of different characters. And, even I guess like a critique someone might make, like, oh, Ray Allen's not a great actor. I feel like Spike Lee kind of builds the movie so that Ray Allen doesn't have to do too much heavy acting, right? Yeah. Like, it's kind of, he's reacting to the people around him and how his impending fame is changing their behavior.
Spike knows how to, knows how to like cut around, not just cut around, but do his setups around that. Like, he doesn't ask Ray Allen to do all too much. Like, it's a very smart approach to a performance that isn't going to be, he's going up next to fucking Denzel. You have to be smart when you approach that.
Yeah, and it's funny too. I forgot to mention this when, we're all pointing out the fact that it has some negative things to say about sports. It is like, has there been a sports movie where an athlete plays an actor and it's not like one of those inspirational like stories? Like, it's kind of funny that they're like, oh, Ray Allen's like in this new sports movie. This should, this could be something for the kids or something like that. It's not it's no Thunderstruck that Kevin Durant.
Exactly.
I never caught that one, but I just assume that one is a little bit more bright.
Oh, yeah. Thunderstruck is just, it's like Mike for the selfish generation of new three-point shooting kids.
For the detestable Generation Z. Spike Lee being involved, you have to know that it's going to have a different angle. And, it's just a really great movie, really good-looking movie, and it's just full of life and full of a lot of great characters. And, Denzel is, he's a great fulcrum point, great center, And it's like, when you don't need Ray Allen to be, chewing scenery when Denzel's knocking him down on the court, Denzel could act for the both of them, what I mean? And just probably the best basketball movie, right? Like, I can't really think of, maybe some people like a documentary, But Hoop Dreams. Yeah, I haven't seen Hoop Dreams, so to be fair, I haven't seen that.
You got to see Hoop Dreams. That's as good as advertised.
Yeah, I need to step up my documentary game. I think that's kind of a lacking part of my toolkit of movie info, which I need to have all the tools in the toolkit. But JT, what's your bullet rating on He Got Game?
I'm going 4.5 bullets as well.
Yeah, I know it's the best basketball movie, top tier sports movie in general. In that moment there of the ball traveling across the prison into the big state court is just one of the most powerful things. And in terms of like flaws, I don't know, Spike Lee is one of those like auteurs where it's just like there are some things that he will have some swings that I definitely disagree with or things that are just like just don't feel right, but I feel like that's part of the fun with his movies, because it's just like you're not going to get like filmmakers as adventurous as he is like all the time, and so if there are sections that are a little bit like clunkier, which like this, the sections in this that are like kind of rough are like few and far between. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. That's just part of the fun, baby. That's just unlocking the man himself. I know it did get me thinking basketball movies and like good premise for a basketball movie. I think you could have one about the classic sort of joke about an NBA player being sent to China.
Yeah,
you could do kind of a Lost in Translation.
I would love that. That would
sort of be thing. So good. Like, yeah, you may be like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm
like
trying
Pat
to think
Connaughton
what type
or something,
yeah,
like
exactly.
That. You know, someone who's just like draining threes in China. You know.
Yeah, I remember having an idea of like some sort of like this could be like a HBO miniseries of a player like Kevin Durant following, like, you know, he's arguing with the fans on Twitter and stuff like that. I say Durant. I don't know why it's specific to Durant, but. Obviously JT's concept's a little bit more developed. There's not really.
Your concept is watching Kevin Durant go on
like,
Twitter and argue with people.
Well, I think
it's like a HBO Girls, but it's like about Kevin Durant modern evaluation of the modern NBA player.
You could kind of mirror the two in getting a modern NBA player who has too heated of a persona and is too vocal about that they have to ship him off to China.
I would like to just have HBO reboot Girls and add an NBA player to the cast. There was the famous incident with Lena Dunham and Odell Beckham Jr., but I don't know how she fares with the NBA crowd. So, you know. All right, we'll be right back on Extended Clip.
Bryant with the save.
Oh, you gotta get a shot here.
Final seconds. Bryant for the win. Bang! Paul falls down and lost the ball.
And you've got numbers right now via the Bucks.
Middleton inside. He backs it home. Timeout, Phoenix. This building is shaking.
Bryant
throws it up.
Everyone knows that you don't need size to compete in this industry. We're back on Extended Clip. We were talking about the sex industry on our break, but we are done talking about that.
The what industry?
What? We are here. It is the NBA playoffs. The games tonight are just about to tip off, and we have basketball fever. That's why we talked about it. He got game. It's because JT is deeply sick. He has the basketball fever, and I'm very brave to be in the same room as him right now. You know, a lot of people would say quarantine, 15 days. You know, you got to get your tests done. But because of this basketball fever we've been inflicted with, I think what we're going to do here for a little segment, a little experimental segment fusing basketball, cinema, and our imaginations of the mind, which is a great phrase I just coined, by the way. We are going to have the first annual extended, I don't know if it's annual, but the first Extended Clip basketball draft. Now, this is not the movie draft that we talked about a couple months back. What was that? 8 months back, where we drafted studio assets like they were a basketball team. No, this time we are drafting a basketball team out of writers, directors, movie stars, musicians, anyone who's involved in Hollywood is up for fair game here. The only stipulation is, you know, here's the thing about Hollywood these days. It's all a diversity, inclusion, fucking jerk-off contest, right? You know? And so there's that element. And the other element is that, you know, what's really hot right now is women's basketball. Everyone's watching women's basketball, buying tickets to see the Fever and the Storm and the Aces, everyone's favorite teams, you know? So you must include one woman on your team to play, because we're trying to, you know, I say fuck women's basketball. Yeah. I think out of context here, I think women should be allowed to play with the big boys because they're that good. They're that good.
It's just basketball.
It's just basketball. Yeah.
Eddie's having a Ryan Russillo moment right now.
Is it just we're doing our starting lineup?
We'll just you got to field a lineup in general. So we pick whatever positions you want, but you're assigning them for your boys and girl or girls. Who knows? You might have three or four. Malcolm.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you the first overall pick in the draft. Wow. How do you feel about that?
Well, there's just so many different directions you could go here. You know, the top of the Hollywood draft.
Imagine you are on the basketball court that used to be on the top floor of the parking lot of the Sony lot, right?
Wow.
You know, and you just got like all of Hollywood chilling and it's your pick.
Well, you know, there's a lot of tall men in Hollywood, you know what I mean? There's a lot of short men in Hollywood actually too, but there's some tall men. There's some guys who clock over 6'2", 6'3". Mm-hmm. You know, but they're not, you know, they're on the slimmer side. So, you know, you're maybe looking at, you know, kind of, you know, the new wave, the Chet Holmgren style player.
Sure.
But I need a guy who's going to intimidate people out there.
Okay.
And if it's not going to be with his size, it's going to be with his persona. And so this might be a surprise to people, but with the number one pick, I'm picking Vincent Price, 6'4". the abominable Dr. Fibes himself. Yeah, I think he's going to scare people out there. I think people are going to be a little bit intimidated by him.
He is a very underrated trash talker. He is probably like the best trash talker in the game right now in terms of Hollywood pickup. JT, you are on the clock for the second overall pick of the Hollywood pickup basketball draft.
This is kind of like, I feel like it's a real cheat answer here, but I'm getting Yorgos Lanthimos.
Ooh, okay.
Because, of course, famously, he was a Greek basketball player. Mm-hmm. Europeans are big in the league now. I think, obviously, he's a little old now. Got to, work out a few kinks. But I think he'll be a key player in my team. And he has the experience, too.
Yeah.
That's the thing. The other guys on the team are going to look to him to learn.
See, here's the thing about Yorgos Lanthimos. Film style reflects basketball style. He's a ball hog. And he shoots like 20% from the field. You know, also you look at those numbers in the Turkish league, he played like shit. His PER was like 6.
He gets off too many shots, just like his movies.
Exactly. You know? He's throwing less on the shots. Wide angle lenses. Just like he's taking hook shots from three. It's like, Yorgos, what are you doing?
But he's a pro. You know, that's one thing you can't take.
He is
from
a pro.
Him. He did go pro. He went pro.
He is the only professional basketball player, technically, in the draft, I think.
Well, okay.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. My pick is Adam Sandler. A notorious basketball player. Adam Sandler is going to be my point guard. He is my one. He is my absolute rock. He is my assistant coach as well. I am coaching the team, by the way. But, you know, when I'm sick, Adam Sandler is the player coach of the team. Malcolm, we're not snaking this one. Malcolm, it's back to you for round two.
This is, you know, the draft, all the draft guys, you know, NFL draft is pretty soon. So there's got to be some draft guys listening who are, they're going crazy right now because this guy should have been the number one overall pick. And, you know, this could get dicey, this could get controversial, but I think he's earned it because he has bona fides in the acting world. You know, he was in great TV shows like Party Down. I have to go with Rick Fox, who is an actor in his own right. You know, and to prevent you from picking other basketball players, it's like Kevin Garnett, you know, LeBron, Michael Jordan. They kind of all just did one movie so far. You know, maybe Garnett's going to pursue more acting
as themselves too.
Yeah, as themselves. You know, so
Rick Fox played a character on some daytime TV shows, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, it seemed like he was legitimately wanted to, you know, not just do cameos, but, you know, act.
Yeah.
And has. I think he was in Holes.
I think the athlete rule is they got to have some roles where they're not, like, if you want to pick a pro athlete on here, they got to have some roles where they're not just playing the athlete, you know? And yeah. Rick Fox absolutely fills that role. Yeah. Also, he was part of some championship teams. That's he's built bringing a winning spirit to your team. You know, he may not have shot a basketball since like 2004 at this point. He seems like the kind of guy who, like, when the Hollywood pickup games are going, he's like, yeah, I've had my fair share of that over the years.
Yeah. Well, because if you do I'm sure he would dominate, but if you on the off chance that he does poorly, it's like you look like shit. Like, it's just there's expectation for you. And also, he's like 6'7". Like, you know, I was looking up tallest men in Hollywood. The close, like 6'4" is pretty much as tall as people usually get. So,
yeah.
But if you do your research, there are some, you know,
yeah,
I'm sure JT's about to prove me wrong.
I have a big man lined up. I honestly, you bringing up real basketball players, I was thinking the obvious big man who I feel like fits our qualifications. Fuck. Is Shaq.
Yeah.
But I'm not gonna go that route.
It's hard not to pick Shaq.
It's hard. Yeah. It is hard not to pick Shaq, but I want a big man in my own right. I'm going with Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca. That man is huge. I'm not sure. I'm still on the fence about whether I'm going to make him wear the costume on the court. I think it would certainly slow him down. I mean, he's a big guy. He's going to be pretty slow getting winded already. But I think like that might be the X factor. That might be like a little shocking sort of flair that you'd need.
Before we go on, just to recap real quick, Malcolm, your picks were Vincent Price and Rick Fox. JT, your picks were
Yorgos and Peter Mayhew, who I believe is 7'2".
God damn. Okay.
Or 7'3".
That's some serious length. I didn't quite know. Was he just actually a Chewbacca? Was there no suit?
I'm going to say Shaq doesn't count.
Shaq.
Even though he's not himself in a lot of movies, it's always with the thing where it's Shaq. You know?
Yeah. True. Yeah. I mean,
my next pick.
Okay.
Star for an entire season on General Hospital, Luke Walton. My mom was in love with him because of that, because she was a soap opera fan. I watched him coach multiple teams into hell, but I always saw him as a very smart player on the court. And I think the guy can coach a pickup game. You know, I'm getting real player coach heavy with Sandman and Luke Walton and myself.
Are you going to be on the team too? Player coach?
Of course. I'm out there. You guys aren't out there with your squad? Come on.
The sixth man? Are you the sixth man?
Okay, Malcolm, it is back to you.
Now, you know, Rick Fox, he might be scoring a lot of points. We got Vincent Price doing, maybe we'll have him at the 4 or 5. We'll see how the rest of the draft goes. But I need a wing. I need a wing to provide me with some defense, kind of be wiry, kind of be, bring that intensity and kind of off-kilter energy that maybe the superstar players on my team don't quite have. And I think this man, I don't know, I think he's got a reputation and maybe this could help him. And so I'm picking Michael Richards as my third pick because he's got a good length on him. And, he's got like a Rodman type eccentricity, you know what I mean?
But
hopefully he'd be good at defense and rebounding is what I'd imagine.
He definitely has some Dennis Rodman in him. That is absolutely true. He doesn't want any more Dennis Rodman in him, though. Trust me.
Somehow I feel like maybe that could help him. Maybe it would hurt him. I don't know. I that predicament, let's just shut up and dribble is what I say. You know?
Yeah. JT, for your third pick in the draft.
Honestly, I'm going like a similar route in where I feel like I need a really good defender. I need like a pest. I don't know. I always like someone who's a little annoying. Like someone the other, like you love to hate, but on your team is going to be a really great asset. And in that front, I have to fill my league demanded diversity quota
Oh yeah.
Forgot about. So that. I'm gonna go with Ellen DeGeneres.
I don't know why I thought you were gonna say Lena Dunham.
No. Ellen is wiry. She's scrappy. She's always fucking dancing. Like she's gonna be zipping up and down the court, like getting all up in there. Like I don't know. I'm anticipating a lot of steals from her. And I mean, you've seen like you've heard the things about her, like really intimidating. Bullying her crew. She's going to be talking smack.
Yeah.
Like crazy.
My next pick is another team leader. See, that's the thing. When I build a team, I want a team full of team leaders. Everyone can be a point guard and a coach and maybe even a president. I'm picking Barack Obama for my third pick.
Wow, I was not expecting that.
One of the biggest producers in town at this point.
Oh my god.
And we've seen him drain threes. It's what I do. That's what he said. So, Mr. President, get on over here.
Whoa. That's what I do.
Malcolm. Mm-hmm. With the fourth pick in the draft, or the fourth round, first pick.
I have to admit, and it's, you know, it's telling that I guess JT picked, but I'm having trouble coming up with my woman pick. I'm sorry. You know, that's not good. That reflects poorly on me. But I'm thinking of someone who's, I guess, played a coach in a show before. So that's pretty close, right? They're at least familiar with the world of athletics. And this woman, she has some length on her. And I think she has some, you know, since it's a co-ed lead, we need something that could intimidate the boys a little bit. You know what I mean? That has a bit of a masculine edge to her. You know, sorry if that's, she doesn't want that. But Jane Lynch is my my pick, and I feel like
an interesting kind of recurring theme with our female picks here.
That is true. Yeah, I you know, maybe I'm kind of just lazily pivoting off of JT's pick, but also, you know, that we need someone to guard Ellen, and I think she.
No, you want to address any potential problems that could emerge in these two picks. I think.
I think Lynch could guard up Ellen for sure. I think so. I think it's kind of a matchup based pick, but she was a coach on Glee, right? You guys remember the show Glee? Wasn't she a coach on that show? So, you know, she knows athletics.
JT, with your fourth pick.
Yeah, I don't know. This is Yorgos, Mayhew, Ellen. It's kind of, I'll be the first to admit it, kind of an unconventional team. I don't know. Not what you think of when you're going to bring home a championship. And I don't know. I realize that I want someone who is a little bit more of a fundamentals style player, kind of a classic hooper. And I feel like with that, you got to dip into classic Hollywood a little bit. I think Vincent Price is a smart pick from Malcolm. I'm also going with a nice, tall, old gentleman, Jimmy Stewart. I feel like he has like a nice, you're talking about the player coach angle, Eddie. I think he has that. We got a lot of hot personalities on this team. I think Jimmy Stewart is going to be able to shepherd them all together into a coherent unit.
Now, when I instituted the one woman policy of the draft, I had my pick in mind, but then when Malcolm started describing Jane Lynch, I thought he was going a different direction and inspired me to change up my next pick. I'm going to go with a former coach of the New York Knicks in the movie Eddie. Whoopi Goldberg,
of course.
Yes,
who is just a magnetic personality. Her and Adam Sandler goofing off on the court, you know, while Luke Walton and Barack Obama are running a two-man game. It's unstoppable. It's someone's gonna make a television show about how great my basketball team is. You know, that's just a built-in fire dynamic. So yeah, Whoopi Goldberg. I'm gonna slot her in at the power forward.
Plus the movie Eddie, your name's Eddie. So you must have a special, you know, attachment there. You know,
Come on. The movie Eddie, the dog from Frasier, stuff like that. Instant five stars in my heart.
Yeah.
The Edwards Theater.
Yeah. I never saw myself represented so much on screen before. Before I saw Eddie.
Before I saw the dog from Frasier and Whoopi Goldberg.
People talk about representation. That's representation. We need more Malcolms on screen. More characters named Malcolm.
We need more Malcolm McDowell late period roles.
True. And McDowell, you know, maybe if this was a 10-person pick, he might be on my team.
He's a big guy
and he's scary in his own right. And he's named Malcolm. So I have an inherent bias. But, you know, we were talking about championing diversity and, you know, kind of, you know, we got to have a woman on the team. And, for me, they say they're woke, but then you pull behind the curtain, a lot of shady dudes making deals, you know. So I want to be diverse, too. And I'm going to pick Christopher Reeve for my last pick. And we're going to get a little bit of wheelchair basketball action on my team.
Nice.
And I think that's important. I think, you know, women's basketball is having a moment. So should, wheelchair basketball.
Wow. My last pick, I think, is in a similar terrain. Again, like I was thinking about diversity and diverse skill sets, things that are going to be a little unconventional, especially like you coming up against my team, opposing team. What are we making of this? Like, what is this? And I also, I mean, it's not just diversity for diversity's sake. I want someone who has legitimate basketball experience. And so my last pick, I'm going with Buddy from the Air Bud movies. the basketball playing dog himself. Bringing a lot of experience to the table. I think it's gonna help shake out the lineup.
And with my final pick in the draft, you know, I want the fundamentals to be represented, right? People always talk about the fundamentals. So I think we need to go all the way back to the beginning.
Oh.
And I am going to put D.W. Griffith. Sorry.
Okay, scratch that.
Good. I'm going to put, because he would not like basketball. I am going to put F.W. Murnau on my team because he was over 6 feet tall, which back in the 1900s, that's like being 9 feet tall.
He was a tall guy, yeah. He was like 6'5", I think. For some reason, I have that impression that he's 6'5".
Experience lends a strong hand here. And, you know, we don't want our basketball players to get caught up in the world of lust. And this is a guy who died, you know, either giving or getting roadhead. I'm always forgetting which way it was. But, like, so his ghost understands, like, the severity of that. He'll be like, look, man, I died already doing that shit. Don't do that, you know?
Don't mess around with these kids, man. They're nothing but trouble.
Okay, so Malcolm's starting five for his team is Vincent Price, Rick Fox, Michael Richards, Jane Lynch, and Christopher Reeve. That is a strange team. I'm guessing Vincent Price is at the center there.
Yeah.
Christopher Reeve is kind of positionless.
Yeah, he kind of roams around. He's a floating defender running into people's legs.
I'm just curious about getting called for traveling.
Does it have to dribble or no?
That's the cheat. That's the hack. Rick Fox could just put the ball in Christopher Reeve's lap and just charge at the basket like it's football. I think because we're doing 8 Mile soon, that must be the Christopher Reeve, the Eminem influence on this episode. I had to shout out Christopher Reeve.
JT is throwing out a killer team on this blacktop on top of the studio lot at Sony Pictures. We got Yorgos Lanthimos. We got Peter Mayhew, maybe in the Chewy suit. We got Ellen DeGeneres. Got old Jimmy Stewart and Buddy from Air Bud. Now that is a well-balanced team, you know?
Buddy's a great lob threat for sure. Yeah. For Allen, Allen could just dish it up to Buddy. That's dangerous right there.
Exactly. That's super dangerous. I feel like it's a lot of like I feel like it's a Allen at point guard, and then like the rest of them are all power forwards, kind of. You know, it's kind of a new strange basketball lineup.
Yeah, yeah, it's the new NBA.
Exactly, positionless basketball. And then my team that I'm throwing out there on the court is Adam Sandler, Luke Walton, Barack Obama, Whoopi Goldberg, and F.W. Murnau.
Look, was I'm it just... Luke Walton or Bill Walton?
I said Luke Walton. Yeah. No, it is Luke Walton. Bill Walton wasn't on General Hospital. You know, Luke Walton was. He was a heartthrob. Look, if I could take Bill Walton, I would. You know, he was
for some reason I thought you
player.
Said Bill Walton. I think maybe I just heard Walton and assumed a Bill, but yeah,
that would have been much better for that. The team. But I'm sticking tried and true to the concept. You know, that was a fun draft. Okay, everybody, that was a fun episode. We will see you next week. Bye.